From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On the show today, saxophonist and bandleader Kamasi Washington. If the name sounds familiar, it's because he's a composer who performs at pop festivals like Coachella, and he writes music for jazz bands and orchestras and hip-hop too. But if you don't know his name or his music, you're in for a treat. That's later this hour. While it may be what's come to be called an off-year election, the anticipation for the 2018 midterms is building every day. Ben Wallace Wells has been writing about primary races across the country, and he sat down with The New Yorker's executive editor, Dorothy Wickenden, earlier this week to talk about what he's been seeing.
Ben, there are a lot of insurgent primary campaigns in the Democratic Party this cycle, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's bid against Joseph Crowley has gotten probably the most attention of all so far. Why is that, and how did she win?
I think part of it is something to do with more than tactics. There's a kind of romance around her. I think that, you know, Democrats have been looking for something to get excited about, somebody who suggests some possibility of the future. And for a time, at least, Ocasio-Cortez came to sort of embody that. She's 28. As of eight months ago, she was a bartender. She's an activist. She is Puerto Rican. I think a lot of it had to do with her district, which is half Hispanic and was represented by an older white man, Joseph Crowley. I think part of it also had to do with Crowley himself, who not only was, you know, fourth in the Democratic leadership in the House of Representatives in Washington, but was also the longtime chair of the Queens Democratic Party, and so had run, a pretty traditional Democratic machine.
You know, we've seen her victory and then her quick embrace by the party afterward did repeat a pattern that we've seen since the middle of the Obama years, where the Democratic establishment quickly, you know, adopts left-wing protest movements from Occupy to Black Lives Matter, the Parkland students, you know, and on and on. And yet the establishment still is kind of holding firm. So the Bernie Sanders did end up pushing Hillary Clinton to the left. Has Sanders and have these other sort of grassroots movements continued to push the party further left?
Yeah, I think further left even than they were at the end of 2016. One way to measure this is just to look at the kind of signal figures who you might say sort of represent the Clinton kind of wing of the establishment, the standard bearers, you know. You see Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, both figures with presidential ambitions themselves. And they've embraced not only, you know, Medicare for all, not only the $15 minimum wage, they've even gone so far as to support in tentative form a federal jobs guarantee, which is something that, you know, until very recently was pretty far out on the fringe of policy ideas. And part of the question is whether the grassroots will be satisfied with that, whether they'll think that is enough, or whether what they have in mind is sort of a broader change in who leads the party.
In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo is being challenged by Cynthia Nixon, the Sex and the City actress, and that it poses real problems for him. So how is he dealing with her? Do you see substantive ways that Nixon's candidacy has changed how Cuomo's governing?
Yeah, I think on minimum wage, certainly. I think in kind of his embrace of unions and their priorities, there has been some substantive movement. It's worth noting that, you know, she's still down to Cuomo by 25, 30 points, depending on what poll you look at. So, you know, we're still looking at whether the kind of progressive ideas that, you know, moved through the Sanders campaign and very obviously animated the Ocasio-Cortez success, whether those will play in a broader stage right now.
Ocasio-Cortez and Nixon are part of this wave we keep hearing about of female candidates, many of them young and new to politics. Talk a little bit about the reasons for that and sort of how they're affecting the party overall.
You know, when you look at the landscape of candidates, there is undoubtedly a huge influx of women. You know, we've seen changes in the way campaign commercials run. early in the cycle, there was a spate of campaign commercials with women breastfeeding on camera to demonstrate their enthusiasm for family-friendly policies. You know, we've seen people talking about histories of their own personal abuse, female candidates, Democratic candidates, in campaign commercials. The fact of the Trump presidency, and I think, you know, now we're going to see with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh for Supreme Court Justice, an increased emphasis, I think, on the threats to reproductive rights and particularly Roe versus Wade. Part of what we're seeing in primaries sort of again and again is a sharpening distinction between how women are voting and how men are voting.
There is also a broader generational change going on in the party. Tell us just a little bit about this tug in the party between bringing in the newer generation and sweeping out the old. Nancy Pelosi, there's a big battle going on about Nancy Pelosi's seat.
Yes, it does feel like in 10 years, maybe even 5 years, maybe even 1 year, the leadership of the Democratic Party is going to look both ideologically and in terms of who is leading it quite different. Just to have a party that is in a way that it hasn't been for at least a generation on policy, sort of a forthright progressive party, and yet at the same time have it still be dependent on, you know, a huge amount of campaign funding from billionaires and dependent therefore on the party leaders who can draw that money. There's an obvious tension and a problem there. It increasingly seems that, you know, even if Pelosi lasts and the leadership team around her lasts through this election, a bigger change is coming.
You know, I want to ask you about the Midwest, which is going to be key both in 2018 and 2020. Wisconsin seems like a really interesting way to examine what's going on as like a group of candidates who are taking on Governor Scott Walker.
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin has an obvious historic and symbolic resonance. It's where the Tea Party Revolution and then the, you know, kind of Republican capitulation to that insurgency. It's where that whole sequence of events really got started. And so there are 10 candidates for governor, and not a single one has really emerged as a front runner. And so part of the idea that we had a year ago about this coming set of midterms was that this fight between the Clinton wing and the Sanders wing of the party would be won and lost, and that there would be a kind of clear view of what the Democratic Party was. That isn't really the case. You know, the party has definitely moved left on policy. It's not so clear that it has sort of toppled the powers that be. And in Wisconsin, I think you see a particularly clear case of that, where, you know, the party just isn't yet sure really like where it's going.
You've been to many parts of the country as you cover the midterm races. What do you find the issues are that voters are responding to? What should Democrats be focusing on?
I think that both core Democratic voters and people who Democrats want to sway want to think of what they are taking part in as a popular movement against conservative elites, you know, that there was this revolution in the country politically, but that things have not changed, that the basic dynamics of power have not shifted, that people's lives have not been improved. I think that's, you know, where the voters that Democrats want to win are. He's for the really rich guys. He's not for the poor guys. It was a lie all along.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks, Dorothy. It's good to talk.
That was The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden talking with Ben Wallace Wells. You can find all of Ben's writing on politics at newyorker.com. Ahead this hour, the saxophonist Kamasi Washington takes me through his audacious new album. That's in a minute on The New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. You don't generally hear the words celebrity and jazz musician in the same sentence nowadays, but the saxophonist Kamasi Washington has come to be both. Washington released his first album in 2015, and it was called The Epic. And the title was pretty fitting. The album featured a full orchestra, choir, multiple jazz ensembles, and it was quite long. The Epic was a hit, though, and Washington was soon being compared to great performers across the genres, from Sun Ra to John Coltrane. He was hailed as a visionary musician who was bringing the political fusion jazz styles of the 60s and 70s into the 21st century. Washington just released a new album called Heaven and Earth, and it's the kind of record you can get totally lost in, hearing something new every time you listen. When I sat down with Kamasi Washington in the studio, I asked his help in decoding it. With such an epical album like this, how does it begin? In what form? And this is the second really long and involved and thematic record that you've done. Does it start out as musical ideas, bits and phrases, or is it...
Well, it starts off as songs. Mm-hmm. And each song starts off as a musical idea where I'll have an idea, but it's not really... I don't really know what it's supposed to be, you know?
Give me an example of that.
The song on Heaven, Vilu Will Be Soul, it started off just as a rhythm. I met someone in Brazil, and she was a really kind of interesting person. Like she was walking around just kind of tapping this rhythm and talking to the moon, and that rhythm stuck with me. And then I was stuck on the rhythm, trying to talk to the moon. Eventually, that rhythm turned into that bass line.
Now, Heaven and Earth is a collection of songs, obviously, but at some point, something suggests itself that there's a coherent, thematic thing going on. What was going on in your life that you think, or in terms of events or out in the world, that really grounded this record?
I was at a place where I was living the life that I always dreamed of living, you know, and I kind of had the experience of like when in 2015 I decided that I could do it, it happened. Whereas my whole life I've been making music and wanting to do something that I kind of was on the fence as to whether or not it was possible. And then at a certain point I said, well, I don't care if it's possible or not. I'm going to do it, you know, which kind of is a sense of me kind of deciding that it can be.
That you give yourself permission to be a professional performing recording musician.
Well, I was already a professional performing musician, but I gave myself the confidence to know that I could make my career about my own music instead of just about me helping other people make their music.
Now, the first track is Fists of Fury, which is a cover of the theme song to a Bruce Lee film. I don't remember that movie. What was it about?
It was originally called Chinese Connection. And basically, Bruce Lee is portraying the pupil of a really great martial artist who gets murdered during World War II, basically, when the Japanese occupation of China, and Chinese people were being abused by the establishment, and this guy decides that he's just gonna not allow it anymore, and he's gonna stop it himself, and he's gonna avenge his teacher, and you know, there's a whole plot of him, you know, kind of going there and taking things into his own hands, and you know. Right. I won't ruin the movie, but yeah.
But at one point in your song, the vocalists, Patrice Quinn and Dwight Tribble, they chant a refrain.
Our time as victims is over. We will no longer ask for justice. Instead, we will take...
We will no longer ask for justice. Instead, we will take our retribution. And to me, that sounds a little bit less like Bruce Lee than it does somebody like Malcolm X. Were you channeling Malcolm X somehow in those lines?
Well, I mean, yeah, but it's definitely in that Bruce Lee movie, for sure. I mean, there's a moment where he says, you know, where he basically makes a decision that he's not going to wait for justice. He's going to take justice. I think that's something that all the people in the world that want the world to be a just place are going to have to do. You know, there's a certain place where you get to where you understand that the justice that we've all been asking for, those who we're asking for it from don't necessarily want us to have it. It doesn't make sense to ask someone for something that they don't want you to have.
Kamasi, you've written political songs. You've worked on political songs with Kendrick Lamar and others. I wonder what you think. There's a long tradition of this in jazz and rock and roll and hip hop. What can a song do in the political world? What effect can it have, and what are its limits, do you think?
I think the major effect that music has, the biggest thing that it does is it connects people. And that's kind of the extent of what the music can do. You know, in the end, the world changes as people decide that it changed. But as a musician, what we can do is kind of like show people that they're not alone, you know, and kind of like bring them together and say, like, look, this idea, this thought that you have, all these people have it as well, you know, and to understand, and that can promote belief, which I do think it's something that is really important, in that as people believe that the world is a certain way, you know, when they truly believe it to be that way, they'll start to make it that way.
When people think of jazz musicians in the traditional sense, they think of a trio or a quartet or a quintet dressed either sharply or conservatively or dully, and they play. And sometimes the back is to the audience and sometimes to the front, but show is not a big part of it. Spectacle is not a big part of it. When you play, spectacle is part of the experience, part of the live experience, in the way that it was with Sun Ra and some other bands, certainly in the 70s and other times. What's your approach to stage presence and spectacle?
I try to be myself on stage. You know, I try to. I mean, because there's a degree of showmanship to even that, like the idea of being completely like aloof or uninterested in what's happening. You know,
in the Miles Davis way.
I mean, I think Miles Davis was coming up in a different generation. I think his reasoning behind doing what he was doing was a bit different, in that, you know, he's playing in clubs where he wasn't allowed to walk in the front door, you know. So for him to turn his back then on an audience, you know, it was kind of a act of rebellion, you know, to where he was at and the where the world was. I feel like myself, I mean, I try to just kind of, in general, when I'm playing music, I'm really trying to connect with the musicians and everyone that's there. So anything that's happening on stage is that, really. I don't have a lot of premeditated things, you know. I'm not the best dancer, and I haven't quite got my six pack together, so I can't rip my shirt off or anything like that.
Now, your father was a musician, and that was an immense influence on you. How did that father-son relationship work in terms of music? He gave you your first saxophone after you sang for him a Charlie Parker solo.
Yeah, you know, I started off on drums, and then I started playing piano, and then I switched over to clarinet. And, you know, my dad's, you know, he grew up as a saxophonist in the 70s, and back then, if you were going to be a saxophone player, you really needed to be a doubler, which meant you need to play saxophone, flute, and clarinet at least, and really also oboe, you
know, in order to work.
Bassoon, in order to work. And so the clarinet is the most difficult of those instruments. And so he really wanted me to stick with the clarinet for a while and get better at that before I switched to the saxophone. And so I snook and just took his saxophone, and I was kind of learning it on my own. And that's when he was like, well, if you're really serious about the music, he didn't think I could do it. Basically,
he didn't think I could
sing the Charlie Parker songs. That was his way of kind of keeping me from playing the saxophone.
What was the Charlie Parker tune?
I think it was Now's the Time.
How does it go? Can you do it now?
You can kind of try to get me singing on the radio.
Yeah,
maybe next time.
That's what the radio's
for. I'll sing for you. we'll go have a drink or something like that, and I'll sing it for you.
So what happened? You nailed it, and he gave you a sax.
I nailed it, and he was surprised that because I sang not just the melody, I sang the solo for him too. And that's when he realized, oh, it's he didn't need to do something like not let me play the instrument that I want to play if I was really serious about music.
Your first experience as a collaborator with a hip-hop artist was with Snoop Dogg. I have to say, listening to your albums, I wouldn't have guessed that. What did you learn from Snoop Dogg? What was that collaboration like?
It was really important. I was really young. And
how old
really,
were you?
I was probably, when I first started playing with Snoop, probably 20, 21, 20, 20
young
years
enough.
Old, 19, 20. Yeah. You know, it was my first time going on any tour. So, and I hadn't really traveled much at all outside of California. And then when I went to play with Snoop, you know, at that point in my life, you know, I had listened to a lot of hip hop, but I had never really played it. You know, I never really like performed it. All of a sudden, I'm in this band and I'm with these musicians who really understand another style of music at a much deeper level than I did. And so I really learned a lot about placement and groove and understanding.
What does placement mean here?
Placement means where and how you play something. So like within a beat, if you think of a beat, like you think of a song as going like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So in between those 1, 2, 3, 4, you can divide that into hundreds of places. And when you play a rhythm, you can put your notes on, you know, closer to, like between 1 and 2, it can be close to 2 or closer to 1. And you can imagine that they kind of hear it as almost like thousands of places. And like where you put the notes is where the groove is.
It's funny, you know, you're one of the few jazz acts I've ever been privileged enough to see where people are dancing. That does not always happen. And do you think your experience with Snoop and the way you learned that sense of time, that sense of placement, adds to that impulse in the audience?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Because it's something that, like, once I understood it, it totally affected the way I play my own music. And you get addicted to it. You want everything to have a groove. You know, it's like, even when we're playing free, there's a kind of a groove, you know?
Well, Kamasi, thank you very much. And I release you into the world. You can go back to the stage or wherever it is. Take care. Be well.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
That was Kamasi Washington. His new album, Heaven and Earth, as well as the bonus disc, The Choice, is out now. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Carmen Maria Machado has written for The New Yorker since 2013, and last year, she published her first book, a collection of stories called Her Body and Other Parties, and it was a finalist for the National Book Award. The stories borrow heavily from horror and fantasy, and they're all connected by a common thread. Women struggle for control in a world that doesn't see their bodies as their own. Machado lives in Philadelphia, and she took us on a short trip back home to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to visit one of her favorite childhood haunts.
We are at the Allentown Farmers Market, which is on the Allentown Fairgrounds. that building over there at the end of the parking lot is where I was born. Not like the farmer's market, that would be amazing. But no, I was born in that hospital. Let's go inside. Oh, it smells so good in here. It looks exactly as I remember it. These signs are so old. I just sort of distinctly remember my mother bringing me here, and I guess it sort of triggered this like lifelong love of markets, like indoor markets. It's weird because it's like there's a high ceiling, but then like the individual little shops have their own like mini ceilings or like mini roofs. Each little one has its own little sign. Chicken pies made fresh. O'Brien's, fresh bread, salads.
Say hello. You guys need anything else today?
Oh, I think that's it, yeah.
I'm very particular. My great-grandmother and my grandmother are Austrian, and they're very just so, very fussy. My omama, God bless her, she would like refold napkins for use later. And everything just had its place, and everything was very just so, and I am that way, for better or for worse.
Good morning, what a beautiful day. Oh my goodness, what a beautiful day. I'd like to tell you about a
dilly beans! Okay, that's what we want. They're like pickled green beans, and they're amazing. Okay. Hi, can I please have a raspberry bear claw?
Cheese Danish are the best.
He's pushing my cheese Danish.
Well, these look beautiful.
Anything else?
I know.
175, 120.
Mmm. Oh my god. You know what that tastes like? Church. I've always sort of taken pleasure in like the specific aesthetic experiences of places like this. Like, I'm really interested in sensory details, and I think that people who have read my work, who've become familiar with my work, are like, yes, like sentences and details are like so specific. And that's not like artificial. Like, it's not like I go in and I'm like, I must make this detail pop. But rather, the way that I perceive the world is this very like these heightened sort of aesthetic beats or pulses. I don't know if it's like you can trace it back to here or just like this was like the first time in my life that I can remember like having that really strong aesthetic reaction to a place.
Have a good day. Enjoy it.
My guess is if you were to like strap like sensors to me, I would react to a place like this the way I would react to dogs. It's like I'm just flooded with serotonin. And I feel like when I'm in here, like I'm like, oh, this is so nice. So it's this like very weird combination of like stimulation and relaxation. Maybe this is like my church. I'm not religious anymore, but I do. I'm like, maybe this is how church felt. I don't remember. It's been a long time, but there's something about this space that, yeah, it just makes me feel just content. Like, I don't believe in heaven, but if I did believe in heaven, I bet it'd be like a giant farmer's market where you have infinite money and you're always a little hungry, but like not too hungry. That's, and there's lots of pickle stands. That's what I think.
Carmen Maria Machado at the Allentown Farmers Market. Her book of short stories is called Her Body and Other Parties. You can find some of Machado's essays and even a recipe for eggnog from last Christmas at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Coming up, journalist Philip Gurevich goes to the Navajo Nation to visit with off-road bikers who've developed their own kind of riding. That's up ahead. Stick around. I'm David Remnick, and next week on the show, we'll spend the entire hour looking at the legacy of one of the great chroniclers of American life in the 20th century, Philip Roth. Don't miss it. This week, cycling fans turn once again to the world's biggest cycling competition, the Tour de France. It's a grueling 21-stage race that takes about 3 weeks to ride. But another cycling event was also taking place this week, and it's a much quieter affair. Over 7 days, a group of Navajo cyclists, many of them kids, are riding 300 miles across the vast Navajo Nation. the reservation that stretches across New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona. It's a rugged, hot landscape and maybe not the most obvious place to stage a multi-day bike ride. But for these young bikers, the landscape has become an endurance test that keeps them close to their Navajo heritage. We sent staff writer Philip Gurevich out to the reservation a few months ago to find out more about the cycling there.
As a kid, you want to do something. I was looking out my little bus window, imagining myself riding a bicycle, right? But I'm bouncing around in there with all that dust and everything. Sometimes I even, with that dust on the window, I would draw a little bike and then just two wheels and the handlebar and just watch it. And as the road is going by, I just see this bike just flying through the area.
So where I'm from, where my clan is from, is up this canyon way at the very end where it starts.
Vincent Salabe tells me this story as we sit on the lip of Canyon de Chelly, which is this spectacularly beautiful spot. It's kind of a mini Grand Canyon. Vincent rode his bike out here this evening. He comes from around here. His family does. His ancestors have, for as long as anybody can remember. He's 38 now, but he took up biking as a kid.
We were in a tough situation with my family about that time. My dad had left. My mom was in between jobs. And during that time, a new man was in the house, very alcoholic, abusive. And I just didn't want to be there. You know, I just wanted to get out, you know. I was 13 years old, and I went on a bike ride from here. A teacher sponsored it with the school. 17 of us got on the road and made a ride all the way down to Texas on mountain bikes from Walmart.
How many miles?
When I checked it, it was around 3,000 miles or something like that. Yeah, yeah. And we were kids, man. So I was the youngest of the group.
That was 25 years ago, and Vincent still seems a bit blown away by what he accomplished and just how far he pedaled, that he kept going. He says he just really didn't want to stop. The bike felt like where he belonged. It clicked with something about him and about where he was coming from.
My representation of that is, you know, that's my horse. You know, that's my horse that takes me places. So that's always ingrained in me, is like that's how my mindset, just trying to explore the lands that I always grew up on.
So a couple of years ago, when Vincent heard that another long ride was being organized on the res, he jumped at the chance to join. This one was a little more tame. Really, anything would be more tame. Just 300 miles over 7 days. It was called the Tour de Sihasin.
So the center right here kind of comes down. Uh-huh. There's a cattle trail that goes all the way up the mountain. Our bike route is out there.
Sihasin means hope in Navajo. The tour was Claudia Jackson's idea.
In our five communities, we had 7 suicides within 3 months.
Claudia imagined this multi-day trip, where young people would not just get to ride a lot, but also to camp out every night, so they would really get to know each other.
You know, that sort of brings us together. We talk about things. We might not talk about that issue, but we get people to talk.
She decided to make the Tour of Sihasin a suicide awareness event. And that first year, she realized she was definitely onto something.
I had 2 individuals on the ride. One was a young boy. He was telling us a story that he had tried, and now he realizes that there's a reason for his life. And then being on the bike ride really made him think, because you're out there in the heat and you're really struggling physically and mentally. People really think out there. And one ride we did, this lady came up to me and she started crying and telling me about walking into her home and her son was, you know, had committed, and she didn't know where to go. And that's when we realized on the entire Navajo Nation, we only had 1 clinician, 1 psychiatrist, just, you know, psychology. Yeah. That's when a lot of things started happening to bring in more, more discussion, because with our tribe and our people, they don't talk about those things. They consider it taboo. If you talk about it, that's taboo. But for us, we knew we had to.
Claudia started thinking that there should be more than a once-a-year event. She started thinking about organizing a cycling team. And she started talking with a former professional cyclist turned coach. Not a Navajo, but he lived at the edge of the reservation in Gallup, New Mexico. named Scott Needham.
Yeah, that was great. That was so special.
I'd met Scott in Rwanda a while back. He was there helping to coach a group of young Rwandans who were becoming professional cyclists. That team, Team Rwanda, became a real success story. Two riders had gone to the Olympics. So Scott knew firsthand how cycling develops resilience and can even restore a sense of self to people who've experienced deep trauma. As it happened, a couple of the Rwandan riders, Nathan Bukusenge and Rafiki Uimana, were visiting the States, and Scott asked them to join him on a road trip to check out the cycling scene on the reservation. When Vincent met Nathan and Rafiki, he didn't say much. He just took them for a ride. Nathan and Rafiki are tough riders. Nathan rode in the Rio Olympics.
Yeah, it's tough because first time we started.
But I don't think they were quite prepared for the terrain.
Different soil. Right.
We'll be coming down right here. Look, I'll show you.
Vincent just hopped on his bike and they hopped on theirs and he led them, riding up and over and down between boulders at the edge of the canyon, then shooting off along the rim, where they appeared in silhouette. When the sunset started to get gaudy behind them, they stopped to take it all in. And Vincent started talking about the history of his people.
The United States government gathered us up, babies and all, whatever we could carry, did away with our livestock right then and there, bam, 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 and said, we're going to go in that direction. And no chains involved, but at gunpoint. The people didn't know where they were going, ended up, they call it Huete. I just know it by Navajo name, Huete. Fort Sumner, that's where it is. We're taking all the way to Fort Sumner. They called that the Long Walk. And very similar to what the Cherokee went through with the Trail of Tears.
And everyone brought up the boarding schools, where so many Navajo kids had been shipped when they were young to be Anglicized, Christianized, deracinated. Vincent was sent away.
I guess you say it grows on you. Yeah, I'm a really short-tempered person. And I just find that I'm mean, I'm angry, and this comes with all of the care that you're given there. You lose track of your surroundings, right? And pretty soon you're just like, hey, it's just me here, and everybody comes individualized. The purpose of our prayer is to remind us of all that is around us. Hayos Kosh is the early morning light. When you go out there, you see it, it's white, right? And then from there, everything grows. When we're out here and we gather as a family and we have these ceremonies and we sing, you become one right there. And from there, we try to encourage one another to stay strong and go against all of the things that are going on around us and that are trying to keep us from growing. And it's really hard to live out here, you know, it's sure. Tough.
When Vincent rode the Tour de Sahasin in 2016, he saw himself and all the kids pushing themselves to hang in there. The youngest rider in particular struck a chord in him, a 12-year-old named Nigel James who was just pedaling his heart out and made it through the whole 300 miles.
I saw how good he was, and I said, why not just get this kid a chance?
Well, he's like the age you were when you rode to Texas.
Perfect. Yes. I see myself a lot in him because at that age, I wish I had somebody to lead the way.
Where Vincent led Nigel was to the kind of riding we'd seen him doing at the edge of Canyon de Chelly, the kind that he felt was truest to who he was and where he was, like he was on horseback. This new form of riding belongs to an entirely different sport than conventional cycling. Enduro, it's called, and it involves going alone, hard and fast, down very, very challenging terrain. It's not a question of pedaling hard. It's more like downhill ski racing on an obstacle course of hard rock and gravel with lots of jumping off cliffs and over crevices. In just 10 years or so, enduro has become a whole world. There are international competition circuits, professional riders, endorsement deals. You can watch some of these hotshots on YouTube videos if you've got a stomach for watching people who appear to be plunging to their deaths. Nigel took to enduro with a passion. So we set out the next morning to see Nigel.
KTNN, your native broadcast enterprise radio station.
We drove, and we drove, and drove, and drove. The Navajo Nation is big. We put 1,100 miles on our truck in 3 days, and we listened to a lot of radio. We are really out there. Yeah, we're on this like rutted dirt road. We're looking to get to Nigel's house, but it's been a long, long time since we passed, even on the paved road, another car or a house. And here it looks like we're coming up into a sizable corral. We came to a horse corral and beyond it to a house with a lot of heavy equipment around it and a traditional Navajo structure being built, a heavy log roundhouse called a hogan. There was a teenage boy there with a ponytail rocketing around on an orange enduro bike. That was Nigel. The Rwandans immediately recognized him as one of their own.
Yes, is it like a BMX track?
Oh, yeah.
BMX.
Yep. Right here is a technical one back there. We have a little playground.
All cyclists together, it's connection. Yeah, cycling, it's a good connection.
It was hard to believe that Nigel had only started riding a bike 2 years ago.
Then I met Vincent, and then he started taking me all over the place. Did my first race September, I think, Flagstaff Enduro. Got my first podium over there. The second race in Tucson and third.
Nigel was underselling himself. He'd been winning a lot of the races. Though he sounded like what he was, a boy very much at home in his parents' house, hanging out, just riding his bike around the yard. People kept telling us he was also a really disciplined and fanatical rider. He never seemed to get off his bike. He had the habit of sort of pulling up, talking for a few minutes, and then he'd just stand up on the pedals and shoot off. He'd built ramps and jumps all around the house, so he really felt that he was at home in a deep sense, like this was his place. He'd made it his place. But he wasn't just a kid who was serious about biking. It turned out he was also a kid who was really serious about the impact of his biking on his land.
Yeah, we're able to build a lot of things because there's so much land here, but we also don't want to do too much because we could be causing erosion, which is why I try to ride mainly on the rock or the hard-packed.
As we were talking, Nigel's dad stepped in.
My mother-in-law, she went to go get the sheep for you. You guys are going to kill it. She said to sharpen your knife.
By you guys, he meant the Rwandans. Apparently, the family, when they realized they were having visitors from Africa, had wanted to make them feel welcome and at home, and had come up with this idea of inviting them to slaughter an animal as their honored guests. The only question was, which was going to die today, a goat or a sheep?
I don't know how to kill a sheep. I don't. Yes.
The Rwandans were like, we don't slaughter goats. Like, well, these people are really far out.
They want to go get it. Yeah, go for a ride, man, and then they're going to bring the sheep up here. Okay.
So Nigel took off, with Nathan and Rafiki trying to keep up with him.
We'll take the little one.
When the knives came out for the goat, it was a goat in the end, a kid goat. The Rwandans were nowhere to be seen.
No!
Nigel's family made quick work of the slaughter. After binding the animal's hoofs and brushing its neck with a sprig of juniper, his grandmother slit its throat. Nigel stripped off the skin, and the severed head was on the grill in about 15 minutes.
It takes a lot of time.
Meanwhile, inside the house, Nigel's mother and her sisters, and their mother and her sisters, and some of the younger children were gathered in the kitchen preparing the feast. The really strong feeling that you got right away, and it just deepened through the long hours of the afternoon and evening we spent there, was that this was a guy who was the opposite of all the alienation we've been hearing about amongst the youth. He was loved. He was cherished. He was supported. He was encouraged. He was being homeschooled, in large part to make sure that he grew up speaking Navajo, respecting the ways of the elders, and to protect him and shelter him and spare him so much of the grief that we were hearing about as a sort of given of much of reservation life. At sunset on the Black Mesa, Nigel's grandparents, his grandfather on horseback, his grandmother walking nearby, started herding the sheep up past the house.
Our ancestors, they roamed this place, so we don't want to go any other place but here. And our kids, grandkids, Some live out in towns and cities, but for us old folks, we don't want to be out there. I don't. I like to roam without any fence as far as I can, this way, that way, out here. But I'm not getting any younger, so I would like to have like running water because of my age. So that's some of the things that we face up here.
For all of Nigel's family's attachment to their land and their traditions, it was striking how much they also completely supported him taking off into the world of enduro competitions, which is really a different world, a white Anglo world. But then, at one of these competitions in Utah, a funny thing happened.
Because, you know, there's not a whole lot of people of color at these places.
That's Nigel's mom. They met these guys called the Yazis.
So we automatically spotted them. We said our yates, yate, which is hello in Navajo, yate.
Yeah, the Yazis, Jarrett and Terrence. Mm-hmm. Those guys are willing to take me in, train me, improve my technical ability. Yeah, but their place is crazy. They just have like big boulders everywhere. And then they have like woodwork connecting them, technical features, crazy stuff I don't even want to try.
Obviously, I wanted to meet these crazy Yazis, but when I asked if we could go out there the next day, it was the only time I felt from Nigel's family, who'd been so welcoming, that maybe we were trespassing a little. I let it go when we settled down to our feast of goat stew and pozole, and the sky got dark, and the stars came out. It was only much later, as we were getting ready to leave, that Nigel's dad took me aside and told me he'd got the word from the Yazis. It wasn't exactly an invitation. It was more like, if you want to tag along with Nigel, we won't run you off our land. The Yazis, of course, lived hundreds of miles away, so we drove, and we drove, and the road led us south and east into a kind of vast gravel pan of a plain that stretched out in all directions. It really felt like the inside of a kiln. It was hot. Just before noon, when the road up ahead appeared to be evaporating in the heat waves, we came around a bend. There was a pickup truck waiting that flashed its lights and headed out ahead of us. We followed and wound up in a yard surrounded by big red rocks. There was a tremendous amount of stuff surrounding a rather modest house, weightlifting gear and broken engines and all manner of scrap metal all over the place. And there were the Yazis. They were big guys, cousins, the younger one Terrence, quite mild-mannered. And then came Jarrett. There was nothing mild about him. He pretty much charged at us. Marvin, Nigel's dad, had a sort of amused look, like, I told you they were crazy. And he made introductions.
So, we got a few guests here.
What's up, man?
I'm nothing.
Jarrett.
Nathan and Rafiki.
Yeah.
Rafiki?
Yes.
That is an actual name. Not a baboon.
Did he just call Rafiki a baboon? He seemed awfully happy to see him, and it took a second for everyone to register that Jarrett was making a Lion King reference.
All cross country?
Yeah.
Nice, dude. You guys kick ass. I saw some of that shit.
Jarrett grew up here, right here. This was his father's house, and like Vincent and Nigel, it turned out, he'd first got into riding a bike when he signed up for a multi-day ride in high school, an anti-drug ride. He liked riding on the road, but the nearest pavement was miles away. And what really clicked was mountain biking. It was the very early days of the sport.
All I knew is there was tires and dirt. And it was fun. Yeah. It's kind of like dirt biking, but without the motor.
He was good at it, too. But in his early 20s, he got distracted.
Got in trouble with the law. Got away from cycling, everything altogether for a while. I had to go do some time.
Jarrett said he had 8 DUIs by the time he went to prison. When he got out, he had a girlfriend who asked him, if you're not drinking, what are you going to do? He said he used to love biking, so she bought him a bike, and he started riding again, working out his anger on his pedals. He started going to races, and he started seeing people riding mountain bikes in a way that was more and more like he liked it, more like the rodeo, aggressive.
Adrenaline junkie, rode horses fast, did everything hard and fast out here. You know, road bulls, fucking road dirt bikes, quads, you know, wrecked 7 trucks, so. brought that all back here. And
Jared wanted to ride with other people, but it seemed to him that the few serious cyclists around didn't want anything to do with some Navajo guy.
Those white fuckers didn't want nothing to do with me. Fucking tried to talk to them. You know, who the fuck are you? So I said, you know what? Fuck you. I'll fucking start my own shit. You know?
So he built his training facility in his backyard, taking full advantage of the landscape to build this death-defying obstacle course. This was enduro before there was enduro. When he and his brother and cousins started showing up at races, self-trained and ready for anything, they got an instant reputation.
Every fucking bike shop knows us. Every fucking good rider in Flagstaff knows us. A lot of these people in the industry know us. Fucking the Yazzie brothers, Resnick riders. Fucking infamous, kind of.
Is that your own title, the Resnecks?
Yes.
That's excellent.
Since Jared had always done it his way, made it up as he went along, not unlike Vincent and Nigel, I wondered if an organized team made any real sense out here. Was that the way to get kids into it?
I want to see more kids, but they're too lazy. They're trying to act white. That's the way I look at it. Our communities are put in together. They want to fucking look good. They don't want to go out and hurt sheep. They don't want to be out in the sun. You know, to be really home is to be out here. Remember your language. I tell these guys, my siblings and my sisters tell me that. Mm-hmm. Remember your fucking language, man. Speak it. Don't be shy of it. I do that. I go to town and I speak it. We're not going to be Navajos here in the near future. It's just going to be a color of skin. That's it. You know? And then they're going to take this fucking, what we have left, the reservation. Say, oh, you guys are not a nation anymore. You're not together. You're broken. And they're going to take it back. And then it's all gone.
As Jared held court, swearing like a Resnick, Nigel and his parents stood there, grinning. And I realized this wasn't the world they wanted to shelter Nigel from. Jared was complimenting them on their choices and how they'd raised their son.
There's no water and there's nothing. You go to herd sheep, you're walking in sand.
Still, they hadn't come for the small talk. They'd all come to ride. And pretty soon, everyone set off to check out the Yazzie's famous setup. First stop was a series of massive red rock outcroppings, boulders that sort of mushroomed out of the ground. It looked like a piece of the planet that had just been created. And one of the first rock faces we came to was marked with a series of ancient white petroglyphs.
We'll meet you up there, Nigel. Oh yeah.
Those scratchings there, are those cattle brands or
no? Those are ancient.
Wow. They are.
Thousands years old.
It's like a lizard kind of thing. The one on the right.
Yeah, why not? Pretty. Go for it, Nigel. Do a no-hander.
Watching them ride these rocks really brought home what Jared Yazzie had been saying, connecting bicycling to the landscape here and to his heritage. It wasn't some Anglo import, the way I had assumed. They had made enduro riding their own, like speaking their own language.
Let it roll. Feather your brakes. Just roll in.
It isn't my language, and it wasn't the Rwandans or Scots' language either. They followed Nigel on their bikes, but they always stopped well short of the rock edges when he took off over them. None of them could do what Nigel was doing.
Yeah, I'm good. I went too high to the right.
Even Jared Yazzie wiped out at one point as he tried to keep up with the kid. He gashed open his arm. As Jared stood there, bleeding and grinning and urging Nigel on, I had just one last question for him. He and his Resnick riders and Vincent and the riders I'd met in Rwanda, like Nathan and Rafiki, were all scarred, each in their own way, by deep childhood traumas. They'd turned to the bike as a way to ride away from their pasts. But Nigel seemed like a happy kid from a nurturing family, a boy surrounded by love, really. And I wondered, did Jared think Nigel could really be the best if he wasn't driven by some kind of pain or demons like the rest of them? What Jared said was, I've got enough for three generations.
Man. I got enough for three generations, man. Let that die with me.
There you go.
Come on, Nigel! Nice job, dude. It's a kid, dude. Fucking. Damn. Oh, yeah, 14, yeah. Thank you.
That was Jared Yazzie of the Yazzie Brothers, speaking to us from the Navajo Nation. We also heard from Nigel James and Vincent Salabe. They spoke with The New Yorker's Philip Gurevich, and you can find all of Philip's writing over the years at newyorker.com. And be sure to take a look at newyorker.com to see photography and videos of the enduro cyclists in the Navajo Nation. It's really something to see. And that's it for The New Yorker Radio Hour today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Until next week, follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Jamie York, Johnny Vince Evans, Trent Williamson, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.